Hello, this is Perry Hoffman, and I'm president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. And on behalf of the organization and the board, we'd like to welcome you to this call-in. The topic tonight is confronting myths and stereotypes about borderline personality disorder, and we're very lucky to have Dr. Richard Hirsch and Dr. Aaron Hoon, who will be talking on this very issue. I would just want to let people know that this call is being supported by donations to NEABPD, and if anybody would like to donate, you can just go on our website, www.borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com, and up in the right-hand corner is a little red font saying giving. We're pleased to say that there are over 100 people on this call, including participants from Australia, Canada, and Dubai. Before I do introduce Dr. Hirsch, I do want to let you know that the call is being taped so that we can post it on our website, and again, that's borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com, so that we ask that all questions and comments be of a general nature, and that you keep in mind that the goal is to have a open discussion, and so we should try to frame our questions to be as non-personal as possible. We'd like to thank you all for joining us. We will have another call-in in a month with Dr. Robert Friedel, and it's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Hirsch, who is an associate clinical professor in psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and associate director of the intensive outpatient program at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Hirsch is also a candidate for the Columbia Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. I turn it over to you, Dr.
Great.
Hirsch.
Thanks so much, Perry. Good evening to everyone. We're going to be talking about the subject of confronting myths and stereotypes about borderline personality disorder. I'm going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then Dr. Aaron Hoon, who is a second-year resident in psychiatry at Columbia, will speak for about 5 or 10 minutes about her experiences as a trainee, and then we'll open up the lines for questions. I've been a big fan of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder since I found out about it, and feel like it's been a pleasure to join in their presentations. And a few years ago, Perry asked me to write a chapter on the subject of confronting myths and stereotypes about BPD for the book she co-edited, Borderline Personality Disorder, Meeting the Challenges to Successful Treatment. So I want to start by going over some of the things that were in the chapter that I contributed to that book. My thinking for a while has been that for any clinician treating patients or clients with borderline personality disorder, there are complicated challenges from making and communicating an accurate diagnosis to implementing appropriate informed plan for treatment. Myths and stereotypes about BPD and the individuals who may carry the diagnosis complicate effective recognition and treatment of the disorder. BPD has been controversial as a diagnosis among clinicians since its inception, and it, I believe, is poorly understood among the general public. There are pressures for clinicians to avoid making an explicit exploration of the diagnosis because of these myths and stereotypes. And the pressures, in my experience, can come from a number of different sources, including other clinicians, family members, and sometimes patients or clients themselves. The results, however, of minimizing or ignoring the contribution of borderline pathology can be detrimental and serious. Clinical decisions that are based on outmoded thinking about diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment efficacy and availability of resources may deny patients optimal care. And this, I think, is a major concern and something that I've seen many times in my clinical experience. Certainly, integrating current findings into consideration of a BPD diagnosis and the design of an appropriate treatment free of misconceptions about the condition may help limit untoward effects associated with failure to appreciate elements of borderline personality. So let's start by looking at the different myths, and I'll take them apart one by one. What I just went over was the abstract to the chapter. one of the myths I think we often hear is that BPD is a rarely seen condition. And this, there is plenty of data indicating that that's not true. BPD is not a rare, and it's certainly not rare in clinical settings. There have been some very interesting studies of inpatient populations and outpatient populations that indicate that patients with BPD are often seen in these settings. We know that individuals with BPD are unusually high utilizers of all kinds of mental health services, so it makes sense that BPD patients are going to be seen. The question is, if BPD is so common, how come it sometimes clinicians might say, well, we never see patients with BPD? Well, there are, I think, a number of different points. Some clinicians may see patients with BPD but don't explore the history, don't feel like there's a reason to do the kind of history that would support the diagnosis. And certainly there have been studies that clinicians, when they're using certain instruments, are more likely to make a diagnosis of BPD than in situations where clinicians have a more free-form assessment. And certainly some clinicians mistake a chief complaint, what the patient has, with what the accurate diagnosis is. And there are some some clinicians who, for whatever philosophical reasons, want to stress alternative explanation for certain symptoms. There are some clinicians who might focus on psychopharmacology, or some clinicians who might not even feel that there's validity in what we call descriptive psychiatry. So there's certainly a number of situations where BPD won't be recognized and diagnosed, but the bottom line is that it is a myth that BPD is a rarely seen condition. The second point, or myth I should say, is that BPD is a diagnosis that is unique for its lack of validity. There are a number of people who remain very unhappy with the word borderline, and borderline is a confusing word, and it is a term that came from many decades ago. But there are other terms in psychiatry that are also somewhat confusing that aren't accurate. The sense that borderline personality disorder is unique in its lack of validity has, I think, been addressed in a number of important papers. Some clinicians feel like because there's a lot of comorbidity, meaning patients with borderline personality disorder may have other personality disorders or other what we call Axis I conditions, psychiatric conditions, some people feel makes the diagnosis a weaker one. But there are others who feel that it's useful to look at the complex comorbidity of BPD, and that can alert clinicians that might be what's going on with the patient. A third myth that's very common is that BPD is a diagnosis that clinicians give to patients who make them angry or patients they don't like. And I think this was something that was widely believed in my training a few decades ago, but a lot has changed, especially since we have so much more information now and so much more evidence that there are effective treatments for borderline personality disorder, and that most patients with borderline personality disorder will have a very good prognosis. So a lot has changed, but that myth that it is inherently a stigmatizing diagnosis, I think, still remains in some circles. Another myth that in my clinical experience I've seen very often is the myth that delaying a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder until treatment for any other plausible Axis I disorder has failed gives patients the benefit of the doubt. And we hear that a lot in clinical experiences. We're not going to make that diagnosis. We're going to give individuals the benefit of the doubt. I think that the problem there is that many patients aren't then given the appropriate psychoeducation about what kinds of treatments are available, they can, and we hear this very often, they can get involved with years of very complicated psychopharmacologic treatment for conditions that never seem to remit, only to be told many years, sometimes decades later, that one of the diagnoses is borderline personality disorder. So the idea that any kind of Axis I disorder, whether it's substance abuse or eating disorder or mood disorder, has to be in remission before a diagnosis of BPD can be made, runs counter to our clinical experience. Another myth that I think it's important to talk about is the idea that patients with borderline personality disorder should never be told their diagnosis because it would cause them undue distress. As I mentioned, some of the longitudinal studies have educated us that the prognosis for borderline personality disorder is much better, certainly than it was thought when I was a trainee. And many patients, when they're told of their diagnosis, actually feel it's a relief. It makes sense. Things fall into place. And then, as I mentioned, the treatments that are available, which are evidence-based, whether that's DBT or TFP or the STEPS program or other kinds of evidence-based treatments, are available. Finally, the idea that it's not possible to treat individuals with BPD because of inevitable liability problems, that's also, I think, something that's been addressed specifically in the, for us as psychiatrists, the APA guidelines, the American Psychiatric Association guidelines for the treatment of borderline personality disorder, which have very helpful information about being able to treat patients who might be chronically suicidal, for example, and do it in a safe way so that clinicians are able to do that and that patients with borderline personality disorder aren't told, oh, you know, this clinician or that clinician won't accept you in his or her practice. And finally, one myth that I think comes up again and again is the idea that the stigma associated with borderline personality disorder would be removed if the name were changed, if the diagnosis were moved to a different category, or if there were a new way of assessing personality disorder symptoms. And I think for us, it's important to come to terms with what the nature of the symptom constellation is and to realize that there have been tremendous advances in the last few decades, particularly in the last 5 years or so, that we have new data and new treatments. And yes, we may move from what's called a categorical to a dimensional way of looking at psychopathology, and that's something that's an issue at the American Psychiatric Association. And yes, there are many people who suggest new names, but it's, I think we're still going to be faced with the challenges, which I think more and more we feel like we have an effective way to be of help in with individuals with BPD. And so that's another myth that I think is useful to look at. Now what I want to do is to invite Dr. Aaron Hoffman, Dr. Aaron Hun, who is a second-year resident at Columbia, to talk a little bit about her clinical experiences. Dr. Hun is a graduate of the University of Illinois. She has a medical degree and also a PhD in English, and the subject of her dissertation was Evaluating the Borderline Personality Disorder, a Study of Identity and Narrative Voice. So I'm going to ask Dr. Hunt to talk a little bit about her experiences in her clinical rotations.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. My name is Erin Hyun, and I'm a second-year resident in training at Columbia University in adult psychiatry. And I did write, as Dr. Hirsch mentioned, I did write my PhD dissertation in English on the borderline personality disorder, particularly cultural and historical perceptions that inform current perceptions of the disorder. And so my role in being here today is to give you the trainee's perspective on my experiences, which actually, for having been on the psychiatric wards for less than a year, has been considerable in working with a number of people with the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, both in the inpatient and intensive outpatient settings. And so hopefully my experiences will bring some light on your questions that you phoning in for today. And my interest really began in the borderline personality disorder as a second year medical student when just the very concept of borderline, the term borderline itself, raises a lot of questions. I wondered borderline between what and what. And that kind of led to this sort of small career that I've made in pursuing these questions, and one question just kept leading to another. In the third year of my third year of medical school, during my psychiatric rotation, I was introduced to these patients who were cutting themselves and telling me that they felt better when they saw the sight of their own blood, and I found that very paradoxical. I would think that you would find it painful, and they were telling me they felt better, and so that it kind of kept leading to these questions that ultimately ended in my dissertation, in which I particularly examined the self-mutilating and identity diffusion aspects of the borderline personality disorder and the ways in which our current perceptions of the borderline personality disorder and its diagnostic criteria really are informed by historical and cultural perceptions and influences. So that's my background, and that's my level of training, and so hopefully my experiences will be helpful today.
Okay. Perry, do you want to open up for questions, or?
Yes, let's start with questions. Thank you so much,
sure,
both of you, for starting this off. And Erin, as I said to you before when we had our prep call, you are our future here. So yes.
That's very exciting to think of it that way.
So we're going to unmute people, and the floor is open. Again, we ask that people keep their questions to a non-personal one, but one that the general audience can benefit from. Okay?
I have a question.
Sure.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please. Yes.
Just in general terms, when you've got a family member who, having read various books and articles and listening to you and talking to people, you have a very strong sense that there is a possible diagnosis. And you've got the whole, what Dr. Hirsch just mentioned about sensitivities and diagnosis, and he mentioned it is a good idea because people get some relief from it. Is it a good idea to go and speak to the person's doctor about what one's findings are, especially if one can be relatively objective about these things? Have you got any suggestions on how to actually help to get to that place where one could actually get a diagnosis and then some help for the person?
Sure. I think our experience has been that we always welcome input from family members. It's extremely useful in putting together a history. And to make an accurate diagnosis sometimes takes a number of meetings. It requires sometimes weeks or months. Having that component of background from a family member is always very helpful. I think you're also bringing up the issue that when a family member has an awareness about the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, is versed in it, has educated himself or herself, that's even more helpful. It sometimes, in my experience, even gives clinicians permission to explore that with the patients, especially, as I've mentioned, given that there is often a reticence among clinicians to either take the kind of history or to generate the diagnosis of BPD. So I think it can be extremely useful and in some ways to the great advantage of a family member to have an educated, informed relative speaking to a clinician. Erin, I don't know what your experience has been.
Well, what I was going to add to that is that this person is very fortunate to have somebody who cares enough about them to have researched the disorder and to want to support them by getting them further help. I can't emphasize enough that was one of the most surprising things that I learned that I've learned this year is how important the support of friends and family and members in the community are, and how much that can really help the person's prognosis as well as their motivation to really remain compliant with their treatment and to get into treatment and stay in treatment and do whatever it takes to maintain their treatment even after they're an inpatient after they're discharged.
Just one quick question after that, because I don't want to hog this, is just to say, what if you end up, because really we're talking about a family medicine type setting, very preliminary, we're not talking about psychiatrists. What if one meets up with, total disbelief and just a lack of understanding or hostility from that family physician? Because from my understanding, the diagnosis is such that, it can be completely hidden and completely unknown to the family doctor, especially if the person hasn't been treating the patient for very long.
Yeah, I guess, again, I think you're always, on safe ground if you are talking about the symptom constellation that you're observing, the features of that, the behaviors. And if you don't talk or get into issues of is it this diagnosis or not, that can wait. But certainly to communicate your assessment of the symptoms as you see them can be very helpful in a preliminary way.
Okay, thank you.
Like a hurricane. Erin?
Yes.
I had a question. Could you expand on your statement about the identity diffusion aspects of the disorder?
Yes. Well, that's one of the 9 diagnostic criteria for the disorder, and I found that very interesting. I really wrote my dissertation on the narrative aspects of self-mutilation and identity diffusion and the relationship between the two.
Dump down for me.
Oh, well, I mean, it is, like I said, it is one of the 9 diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder. It's a markedly and persistently unstable self-image or sense of self. People with the disorder will often describe it as a sense of emptiness in their core and not having a sense of identity or self. And so, and that is one of the diagnostic criteria for the disorder.
Okay, but could you, the narrative, and could you explain what you found and give some more detail on that one?
Sure. Actually, I mean, what I wrote about was really essentially challenging some of the myths surrounding the negative stereotypes of borderline personality disorder. In terms of really, I focused on the identity disturbance and the self-mutilating aspects. As far as the identity disturbance aspects goes, I really wrote about how it's really a matter of that lack of sense of self. And in terms of the diagnosis traditionally having a lot of women who were diagnosed with the disorder, especially initially, the first person historically who wrote about the disorder in 1942, Helena Deutsch, really described it as seeing these women in the clinical context coming in, these really bright, talented, lovely women who just couldn't figure out a career path for themselves. And I found it very interesting in my investigations that historically, when women are diagnosed, when women kind of present with identity diffusion characteristics and do happen to be talented and can maybe do whatever that they choose to do if they can figure something out, that it's described as a sense of emptiness and identity diffusion. Whereas when I looked at the male counterparts historically, I mean, since the Renaissance, they're described as a jack of all trades characteristic. And the example I used in my dissertation was the movie Catch Me If You Can, where there's this 16-year-old boy who really takes on a number of different identities and personas and really commits a lot of crimes, which was the concern that these women, regarding these women who came in with and were described as having identity diffusion, that they could be susceptible to a life of crime. And so that's really what I meant when I was looking at the cultural and historical context of the disorder, especially also one of the aspects was from a gender perspective.
Thank you.
Sure.
I guess I have a question. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Recently, I guess I've been diagnosed with BPD. I don't know if I'm seeking validation or what, but in regards to Dr. Wan, her comments about self-mutilation, I don't have that characteristic, but the other eight, you know, it's heavily involved with my life. The lack of career choices, yeah. The, you know, hard relationships, it's all of that. So with this diagnosis, how do I move forward?
Right. Well, I think, you know, one of the things I mentioned is that there are a number of evidence-based treatments for BPD right now, and there are a number of different kinds. Again, DBT is something a number of people are familiar with, dialectical behavioral therapy. There's transfer focus therapy, mentalization therapy. There are different kinds of treatments, and the treatment, to be tailored to the needs of the individual. But I think you can certainly start by educating yourself about the treatments. The NEABPD website has a lot of excellent information that applies to people, you know, that can apply to people all over the country. I don't know if that is a helpful answer.
Right, okay. So my next question is, you talked about the comorbidity,
meaning yes. more than one condition at a time.
All right, so I've been diagnosed with anxiety and depression.
Yes.
So is that a predominant characteristic to BPD?
There is a tremendous amount of comorbidity with mood disorders and anxiety disorders. I think one of the pieces of good news is that those are very treatable conditions with different kinds of therapy as well as with medication. Not uncommon for there to be comorbid conditions, meaning more than one thing going on when an individual has BPD, but certainly depression and anxiety are very treatable conditions.
Okay. May I ask a question?
Question?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to follow up on the gentleman's question with regard to the identity diffusion and the response that he got from Dr. Han.
Yes.
With regard to the male counterparts who think of themselves as a jack of all trades, and they take on a lot of different personalities and resort to crime. On a societal level, I was just curious as to our prison populations, and have you looked into that with regard to what diagnoses do these individuals have? Do they have there been a lot of people that have been put in prison that, in fact, do have this personality disorder?
That's a very interesting question and something that came up frequently during my medical training. And I wonder if Dr. Hirsch agrees, but that there's a very big question in the axis, the B axis of the cluster B axis of axis 2 personality disorders. There is a personality disorder called antisocial personality disorder,
mm-hmm.
and there's the borderline personality disorder. And it's often the question has come up. Wondering if this is a gendered split between a predominantly male tendency to diagnose men with those qualities as antisocial and a tendency to diagnose females as borderline. And certainly studies have shown that an inordinately high population of prison inmates do carry a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder and have traits consistent with psychopathy, for which further research and brain imaging studies are being done currently to try to bear that out. But yeah, that's a really interesting question, and one that hasn't been answered, but definitely has been raised.
Thank you so much for your answer. Can I just follow up with one question?
Sure.
I was just curious that if they are diagnosed with an inappropriate or the wrong diagnosis with antisocial personality disorder, their treatment is not going to be it's not going to be able to be helpful to them. They're going to be focusing on other issues. So how is this progression of wrongly diagnosed individuals that are being put in the prison system? I apologize. I think you pretty much answered that. That at this time you said that we are looking into this population and trying to differentiate between antisocial personality disorder and if in fact there are BPD components to their disorders. So you did answer me. Thank you.
You're welcome. And absolutely, your question raises the larger question, or the importance of having the correct diagnosis and not, and making sure that diagnoses are accurate and correct, because treatment is variable and depends on an accurate diagnosis.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Hurd?
Yes.
I'm a physician, not a psychiatrist, and I was married to someone with BPD for 20 years. One of the things that I noticed in this person and in other patients of mine who probably have personality disorders is that some of these diseases seem to erupt or explode at certain times in their lives, and then they go into a period of quiescence. But I haven't seen that described very well in the literature. Is that true in your experience, and is that perhaps an artifact of the fact that many people with personality disorders don't stay in therapy with the same therapist for long periods of time, and so this may not be well described?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding from the two landmark longitudinal studies is that certainly the way I was taught that BPD is something and other personality disorders are relatively fixed, that hasn't been consistent with the data, that in fact one of these studies is now at 12 years, if I'm not mistaken, that a really significant number of individuals with BPD no longer meet criteria for BPD, quite high, I would say. My understanding is over 80%. However, there are different kinds of symptoms that have been identified in individuals. Some which do clearly remit, and you use the word erupt, and that brings to mind some of the impulsivity, certain kinds of angers, and those do remit. And then there are other elements of BPD that seem to persist even when individuals no longer meet criteria. And it's one of the reasons why many individuals with BPD are encouraged to and are helped by long-term therapy even after they no longer meet criteria. So I think your point is consistent with the evidence, as I understand it, that a number of patients, some in treatment and some no longer in treatment, no longer meet criteria at follow-up, and only a small group are persistently seen as meeting the diagnostic criteria over time. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's my understanding.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I would like to ask a question, if I might. As you're discussing people not meeting the criteria at a certain point in time, what would you say about recovery? Do you think it's possible, or would you consider that a myth?
Oh, I consider recovery absolutely to be possible. I think that, again, I'm making reference to two long-term studies that show rates of recovery, which were, again, much higher than certainly was taught to me when I was a resident. But I think that there are some symptoms that seem to recover more clearly, more rapidly, and some symptoms that seem to persist over time. So I think this is where the treatment interventions clearly come into play, and looking at those persistent symptoms that I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think individuals can be helped tremendously over time with the appropriate treatment, whatever it is, whether it's based on DBT, a supportive psychotherapy, a transference focus therapy, mentalization, whatever it is, a group therapy. I think there's every reason to be optimistic about prognosis and recovery. Erin, I don't know if that's also how you're taught
that's,
now.
From a trainee's perspective, it's multifaceted, the treatment approach, whether it's medications to alleviate symptoms of people with borderline personality disorder may be experiencing. There are, as Dr. Hirsch just mentioned, an array of therapy treatment options such as DBT, transference-focused psychotherapy, et cetera, and there's more even coming to light as we speak, and those are also very helpful in individual psychotherapy, and so it's a multifaceted approach that can kind of work at alleviating symptoms of the disorder from a multiple and a variety of angles, and I find that very encouraging and very helpful, and I've seen that be very helpful to many patients that I've worked with.
One of the take-home points that I certainly got from Dr. Zanarini, this is her area of research, is that some of the symptoms that might cause someone to be in the hospital, for example, might remit over time. But some other symptoms that might, for example, make relationships difficulty or cause problems in a marriage or something like that, those might persist. And again, I think that there's it may be that certain kinds of symptoms are likely to remit, and certain other kinds of symptoms may persist and may require, as Dr. Hahn is saying, psychotherapeutic interventions to help individuals over time.
Dr. Hahn,
actually, I'm somebody who's been recovered from BPD for 14 years now, and I know what that means to me, and I continue to try to tell people about it, but I guess I'm just wondering, from what you've said just here, it sounds like there isn't actually a professional working definition of recovery that is somehow not lagging with some symptomology left over. Would that be fair to say?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that making reference to a particular study. I think there's a variety in all of the longitudinal studies, and certainly in our clinical experiences, there's a wide variety from persistent symptomatology to partial remission to full remission.
Okay, thank you.
May I ask a question, please? This is Joan. I'd like to ask a question to Dr. Hunt, please.
Sure.
Yes.
I have heard there's some paranoia that sometimes exists with the borderline, but what about the delusions? For instance, someone who is cutting themselves yet saying when the police arrive, maybe my parents are doing it, or later on when they move out, my friend is doing it. Can you speak to delusions with BPD?
Can you clarify your question? I didn't quite understand the part about if they're cutting themselves, maybe the police or your parents are doing it?
Well, someone who is cutting themselves
mm-hmm.
and probably has been given a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder,
mm-hmm.
but has also had a history of delusions. I was just wondering, when I'm reading the literature about BPD, I don't see much talk about delusions with borderline. Is it a common occurrence with borderline to have delusions?
It's not. That would be considered, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Hirsch, but that would be considered a comorbidity. Delusions are often associated with other diagnoses, such as a delusional disorder or a psychotic disorder, such as schizophrenia, or a psychotic feature of a disorder, like depression or bipolar disorder. There is something associated with borderline personality disorder, micropsychotic episodes in which the individual will transiently lose touch with reality, and that's often in a sort of dissociated-like state, and that's often the state that individuals with borderline personality disorder will describe when they're cutting themselves, like almost like they were in a trance-like state or dissociated, or they'll come to and see blood everywhere. So I'm not quite sure if that's what you mean by delusion or an actual delusional disorder where an individual has an actual fixed belief about the world or something about themselves that can't be reasoned with.
If that is the case and they're really not delusional, is it more typical for someone with BPD to actually know that it's them that's cutting but like to blame it on someone else?
You know, it's very individual. There are so many, this disorder is so many variations on a theme. We have general diagnostic criteria, and there's 9. And to fulfill the diagnosis of the disorder, you have to have 5 of the 9, but at least. And so as you can imagine, there are so many different various combinations. And of each combination, it's also very specific to the individual who's experiencing them. So I can't quite comment on that from a general perspective.
Well, I thank you kindly.
You're welcome.
Well, I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I am a recovered BPD and a close member of my family who happens to be 81 years old, showing all of the signs. And I'm wondering if there's any special consideration or any guidance for a pathway for help for this person, given her age.
Yeah, I know from my own experience with trying to make that kind of referral that I found very challenging to be able to get assistance for individuals with BPD in the geriatric population. I had personal experience of trying to make that kind of referral, and again, found it unusually difficult. I don't know, Perry, if you can speak to that at all, if what kind of resources might be available.
You know, I'm getting confused with the background. So,
okay. The question was was about resources for individuals with BPD in the geriatric population and how you would...
Yes, actually, Tom Lynch has done work on that.
Okay.
And what we can do is we can do some investigating through PubMed and maybe post something on our website about BPD in the geriatric population.
Great.
Can I just ask a question with regard... Hello?
Yes.
Just a question regarding treatment where there are comorbidities. I get the impression from what you've said so far that with something like BPD, you know, psychotherapy as opposed to medication is probably more the way to go. Am I right in that? I mean, if you're looking at someone who possibly has got BPD-NPD type combination, and, you know, if there is sort of depression that goes with it, maybe there's medication for that, or is there medication with regards to those mood swings, or is that not susceptible to medication?
Well, I think that the general rule of thumb is that there's certainly data and clinical, we have had clinical experience where medications are very useful for treating certain symptoms, but the treatment of BPD overall, as Dr. Hahn suggested, likely is going to involve a number of different modalities, and to assume that a medication, for example, is going to address that, in our experience, it's highly unlikely. The American Psychiatric Association guidelines for the treatment of borderline personality disorder reinforce some kind of psychotherapy as a cornerstone of treatment with different adjuncts possible, again, as Dr. Hahn suggested, whether that's medication, groups, other kinds of interventions. So I don't know, Erin, if you have any other thoughts about that.
I think a combined, from a training perspective, a combined approach is the best approach. If there are symptoms that can be alleviated by medication management, and then as well as psychotherapy would be the most effective form of approach to treatment, as opposed to just psychotherapy or medication management alone.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question about the comorbidity.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier that you're finding that people with borderline also have other, maybe one other personality disorders. Is there any one in particular that you see in combination with borderline more often than others?
I know that there's data on this that I can't quote off the bat. I don't know, Erin, if you remember the comorbidity, the personality comorbidity data?
I'm more familiar with Axis 1 comorbidities. Okay. I know in terms of cluster Bs generally, but I don't have any data to support that.
Okay. And Erin, you mentioned something about micro with the delusional question.
Micropsychotic episodes?
Okay. That's what it's called. Okay. Micropsychotic. And then also, someone mentioned something about brain imaging studies. Is there something that you find from brain imaging studies in relation to bipolar, borderline?
There is an emerging body of research that involves neuroimaging individuals with borderline personality disorder. I think what has been most useful is that it's informed our thinking about how we're looking at different components of the disorder, and I think in looking at the biologic underpinnings, that's been my understanding of what the overarching direction has been to look at the different dimensions, whether it's impulsivity, for example, or affective instability, emotional dysregulation. That's how I think clinicians like Dr. Hunt and I are using what the neuroimaging studies are producing to inform our clinical work. Erin, is that how you think about it at this point?
Absolutely, okay. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So if a person is showing more impulsivity, you would look at a brain imaging study to see if that area of the brain is not...
No, I wouldn't say necessarily. At this juncture right now, we would not routinely recommend neuroimaging.
Right. But if you do look at that, that's what you would do. If they're affective, their mood, whatever, you would look at that area.
There certainly are studies and again, emerging body of work indicating neuroimaging that are looking at those different component parts of the disorder.
I guess I should clarify that what I meant earlier when I was referring to neuroimaging studies is it's not at the point where it's being done for diagnostic purposes for people, like to diagnose them, but research is being done to try to get to the underlying neurological pathways or circuits that may account for some of these symptoms or characteristics of the disorder or the disorder itself.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Erin, if you go to the NEABPD website, sorry, this is Krishna we're talking here, I'm with the NEA, you will find there's a section there on the videos, and there is, there's certainly one or two that are very good on your imaging.
Okay, great.
I think it's Dr. New, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Susie here, may I ask a question?
Sure, please.
Yes, I'd like to go back to the original question that was posed.
Mm-hmm.
I understand if a patient is under active care by a psychiatrist that it helps the psychiatrist to come about a diagnosis when informed, by family members. How can you bring about a diagnosis for someone if they are not under active psychiatric treatment?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, something got blocked out. Could you repeat that?
The last part.
Yes. Is it possible to bring about a diagnosis if someone is not under a psychiatrist's care?
Erin, do you want
to? Sure. I mean, if does the person have a primary care physician or a doctor that they go to?
This person is now in a nursing facility. Dealing with all of the issues that presented throughout their life. They are not under active psychiatric care there.
I think that it's definitely possible to bring it up from the perspective of a concerned family member that you've done research and that you think that your family member, as you know them probably best, has exhibited characteristics of, at one time or another of these symptoms, and to bring it up to a treatment or provider that this person may have contact with and have a discussion with them, and hopefully they would be able to guide you in the appropriate way to getting further help if after, you know, further discussion with this provider you still think that that this might be a relevant diagnosis for your family member. Does that make sense?
Is it completely inappropriate for a family member to approach the individual with what they believe they understand to be a diagnosis?
Not at all. In fact, with personality disorders, it's the family members and the friends who usually first bring it to attention. It's something I learned in medical school and in training is that often in people with personality disorders and pure personality disorders, they're often the last people to recognize that they have a problem and to want to seek treatment. And sometimes when they do, it's often at the urging of a family member or a friend who's very concerned about them, or if they're having other symptoms, such as depression or anxiety, that drive them to seek treatment and help.
I have a follow-up question. Oh, go ahead.
I just want to follow up with that you find that at least some individuals with personality disorders are receptive to hearing that.
Absolutely, and they are, but sometimes they're not. And so I guess my point in saying that is that it's very helpful to have family members and friends bring it up with either the family member they're concerned about or, you know, and ask them if it's okay to speak with their providers about it. And in many cases, it may be the individual themselves who seeks treatment, but often it's also the case that a family member or friend urges them to look into it further.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to add follow-up on that.
Yes.
What is the genetic influence with BPD diagnosis? They say that there must be an immediate family member or at least one family member that would be diagnosed with a personality disorder in order for you to even get this disorder. I'm just asking, what is the hereditary or genetic influence and or information that plays out with this disorder?
I mean, I think that we're the genetic basis for PD or the possibility of that, we're really only in the early stages of considering that in clinical practice. I guess I'm not sure that it sounds like you've been told or someone is or you've read that individuals with BPD always have that in their in their family, and I don't know that necessarily to be the case. I think there's a lot we don't really understand about the genetics of the disorder right now. Just as there's a lot in other areas of psychiatry we can't fully understand right now, in terms of the genetic basis for other psychiatric illnesses, Erin, is that how you understand it?
Yes, I've not actually heard that before, that in order for somebody to be diagnosed with a personality disorder, that there has to be somebody in their family who has a personality disorder, but something that...
a history of family members, yeah.
Sometimes that is the case, you know, and I'm just speaking from firsthand clinical experience, which is limited to a year of inpatient and outpatient psychiatry, but so far in my training, but... sometimes you see people who come from families where there are personality disorders, and sometimes I have seen patients who come from families where there is none, at least not diagnosed that anyone knows of. But something that we're also taught in training is that it's an interaction between the environment and your genes that really can lead to the emergence of symptoms. And so it's not really purely one or the other, the genetic aspects or the environmental aspects, but really an interaction between the two.
Okay.
Just follow up on that. Yeah, just to say about the genetic versus the environmental factors. So, you know, if you've got this sort of family background where clearly there are issues, and you've got someone who you suspect has got borderline and would be extremely resistant to such a diagnosis simply from the stigma of mental illness, that maybe a multi-pronged approach prior to actually approaching this person, so that everybody else who could be fairly objective about it, such as their family physician and other family members who could be more objective and receptive, perhaps could get on board first before some plan is put into place as to presentation of this to the highly resistant possible patient.
Excuse me, Perry.
Yes, Erin, I'm just wondering before you go, if somebody could put their phone on mute because we're hearing a double conversation in the back. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, and Erin, I'd be interested to hear what you say, that sounds like a very reasonable and sensitive kind of approach with a family member. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Thank you. And I just wanted to end with the fact that for all three of you, I just want to thank you so much for addressing an issue that is just so devastating in our culture. And it is increasing so rapidly. We need the help. And I just can't thank you enough for what you're doing.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for saying that. Sure. We have about two more minutes. We could take maybe another question.
I have a question on borderline and eating disorders. Do you know which symptoms you should focus on or target first, or do them both at the same time?
Well, Erin, you're on the eating disorders. No, I think we always start with safety first.
Okay.
So if an individual has an eating disorder with an associated metabolic instability of some kind, that comes first.
Okay.
However, if the safety issue is part of the BPD and it's say suicidality, we start with that first. Erin, you're working with this specific population now. You can. Again, what are your thoughts?
My current rotation is on the eating disorders research unit here at the Psychiatric Institute, and I absolutely 100% agree with Dr. Hirsch and that it's about safety first. But aside from that, your question raises an interesting question that Dr. Hirsch actually brings up in his chapter about myths and stereotypes about borderline personality disorder in terms of, you know, eating disorders is considered on the DSM diagnostic criteria to be an Axis 1 disorder, whereas borderline personality disorder is considered to be an Axis 2 disorder. And traditionally, in terms of from a training perspective, we defer any types of diagnoses or new diagnoses on Axis 2 until we stabilize the person's Axis 1, which is in this case would be the eating disorder. So that's how we sort of treat it on the eating disorders research unit here. And in terms of what I learned in training is that first you would treat the eating disorder, make sure that the patient was at a stable weight and not engaging in a series of harmful behaviors such as restricting and binging and purging. And as they kind of come to their ideal weight and some of the thinking and the thought distortions may resolve in response to that, it will become more clear as to whether or not you are in fact dealing with a personality disorder, or in fact this was part of the eating disorder and the severity of the eating disorder itself. But Dr. Hirsch could probably speak more to this in terms of the pros and cons of deferring on the personality disorder and making that diagnosis and treating that until the eating disorder is first stabilized.
Well, again, it's safety first, but of course some eating disorders are chronic, and sometimes you have to do more than one thing at a time. I guess that's the short answer to that.
Right. Well, I think we're going to have to wind down. I want to thank Richard and Aaron so much for this. I know, Aaron, you're going to send us an abstract on your dissertation, right?
Yes, I am.
And we're going to post that on our website so people can get more information. And it's just been a pleasure to have both of you run this hour for us. For those of you who still have questions and might want to send them in, you can send them in to neabpd@aol.com, and we'll pass to our two presenters.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so
it's
much.
It's been wonderful.
And Trisha, we really,
and we have we'll have another call on March, May 8th, so we look forward to people signing up for that one as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.